Hi, everyone, and welcome to Resilient People. I'm your host, Janet Finacki. This is a show where I interview regular people who are admired for their resilience, as well as experts who help us to be resilient. Today, I have Dr. Kara Uy joining me. She's a Toronto psychiatrist and sleep expert. Dr. Uy specializes in treating children and specifically teens, but everyone can benefit from her tools and advice. We discussed how sleep impacts everything in our lives, from our productivity to our relationships. And when we get sleep on track, it enables us to manage everything so much better, helping us to be resilient. But before I share our conversation, I should preface it by saying how much I struggle with getting a good night's sleep every night for years. It has little to do with being in midlife and more about my lifelong habits and, as I learn, the setup of my bedroom. So without further delay, here's my conversation with Dr. Kara Uy. Dr. Kara Uy, welcome to Resilient People. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
It's really nice to have you today. So let me just give a little background information on you. You are a psychiatrist in Toronto. You're also a podcaster. You're a mom. Mm-hmm. You have training in cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. What am I missing?
I'm also a sleep physician.
Can we start by learning the connection between psychiatry and sleep?
Sure. So there are lots of different ways in which the two are intertwined. I think the most obvious way is that we know that a lot of psychiatric disorders, sleep gets disrupted. So if you think about what happens with depression and anxiety, sleep is actually part of the diagnostic criteria. I think the other thing to know is that oftentimes if there are other sleep conditions going on, so for example, sleep apnea or insomnia, right, leading to less sleep or issues around the timing of sleep, those things can often present with psychiatric symptoms. So I think a classic example is a kid who has obstructive sleep apnea can really look as if they have ADHD. And then when that's treated, a lot of those symptoms can go away. Another thing to know is that sleep, when it's not going well, can increase the risk for psychiatric disorders. So it makes it more likely to have a mood disorder, a mood episode, anxiety, mania, substance use. So that also is another way in which it plays into it. And then I think another way in which often it's not talked about is how when sleep is disrupted, how that can get in the way in terms of treatment. So for often when treating psychiatric disorders, a lot of it is non-medication based. And so things like you're having to learn new habits, you're having to learn new skills, and that becomes very difficult when you're not sleeping well. And it can be really concrete. Like for example, I work a lot with teens with insomnia. When the sleep is really, really dysregulated, that can result in them not being able to go to appointments. Or even in extreme cases, if people are literally coming into the home, if they are there at a time when a teen is not thinking it's time to be awake, which is a very common thing that I see, it's very difficult to do really anything, right? It's difficult to engage when you're just kind of a zombie, essentially. So there's that. And the last thing I would say that, again, I don't think a lot of people talk about is how intervening around sleep, I'm always talking about how it's such a great place to start. Because once you get sleep on track, then you have energy. Often you can get sleep on track fairly quickly compared to other things, for example, like addressing mood and anxiety. And so it can be this really great win that I've found in my practice, where it can kind of result in more confidence around being able to tackle other things and more agency, right? More of a sense that you can take control over certain things and that you're able to make changes in your life. So that was a long answer, but I would say there's lots of different ways in which I've found that they're just completely intertwined, psychiatry and sleep.
So interesting. You know, oftentimes we don't really think about psychiatry as being the specialty that is underlying sleep disorders. When do you feel that parents should be thinking about building those good sleep habits for their children?
So I would say from day one, it's always, I think, easier the earlier you get in there. And I would say, just thinking about the fact I work often with teens and young adults, I would say I'm often talking about how those years are like a perfect storm for sleep issues, for insomnia, for sleep timing issues. And also, if any of your listeners have teens, they know that there's a really tricky dynamic between parents and teens. And so that really, really impacts the ability to get in there and help, and for teens to want to address their sleep. And so I think definitely before the teen years is ideal if possible. I find it's much, much easier to intervene if you're kind of getting in there before things get really tricky in the teen years. But of course, also during the teen years, just whenever, right? Whenever you can is great.
For myself and my group of friends, when our kids were going through those years, oftentimes we'd be saying that our kids are sleeping too much, that their sleep is all over the map. We would be going to bed at, let's say, 10, 11 o'clock at night, maybe wake up in the middle of the night for whatever reason, still see that their room lights are on. What is going on with our teens that they are just not wanting to go to sleep?
Yeah, so it is really common that parents will actually say that their teens are sleeping more, but what's actually occurring for most teens is that they're sleeping much less than they need to. So teens actually need about 9, 9.5 hours of sleep. Normal is, or the guideline is, between 8 and 10 hours. But what occurs in the teen years, or a big thing that occurs in the teen years, is that their body clock, there is a natural delay in the timing of that clock. And so as compared to when they were kids, let's say they wanted to go to sleep at 9 p.m. A normal timing for the body clock for teens would be maybe 11 p.m. or even a bit later. And so that often then leads to teens sleeping later in the day when they can, right, on weekends. And it can look like they're much sleepier. And I'll say, you know, there might be some parents thinking, my teen's not asleep by 11 or 12. It's more like 2 or 3. And so another thing I always educate people around is that it's very easy to shift the timing of the clock later. And the things that shift the timing of the clock later is essentially getting too much light in the few hours before sleep, and then also overnight. So because now we have access to light all of the time and screens, and that's just such a big part of how we live our lives, and in particular how teens live their lives, it's very easy to shift the clock later. So I think that's probably what many parents are seeing, is that they're seeing the sleeping in, sleeping on the weekends, that time when you would be seeing your teen, that's when they're trying to catch up on their sleep.
What are some of the realistic fixes as parents so we can help our kids to get a better night's sleep? Because the reality is that there is no escaping the artificial light in many ways. You know, the computers, the tablets, the gaming, it's endless. I mean, when I compare my generation, what we had in high school, which was, you know, tape cassette recorders with our mixtapes and the phone that plugged into the wall, to what we're dealing with as parents with our kids, what are some realistic ways that we can help them to get a healthier lifestyle, better night's sleep?
So it is a perfect storm. It's very difficult, although very doable, for teens to sleep better. Because there's a lot of stuff that needs to be addressed, you need to start with just a few really basic things. So one thing that is very often driving difficulties with sleep, falling asleep, is people timing their sleep too early. And it might be that they're timing their sleep too early based on the current timing of their body clock. That's something I see all the time with the teens that I work with. And then the second thing is that you need enough time, and you need to have been active enough during the day to build up biological drive for sleep. So we call this sleep drive. And sometimes people are just trying to time their sleep before they have that potential for sleep. And when you do that, not only does that set you up for just lying there and getting frustrated, but also it creates a perfect opportunity for worry. So that's why I actually often get people, or I always get people, to start with understanding these concepts of the body clock and sleep drive, and then timing their sleep accordingly, because it just cuts out that opportunity for the worry and the frustration that then can take hold and then make it very difficult to settle.
So it's almost like there's a math involved in.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So,
and actually I literally use something called the 14-hour rule with the teens that I work with. And so it's not perfect math. And so I want to caution people that you don't want to hear too, or you don't want to expect that you're exactly going to be able to fall asleep 14 hours later, but the body typically needs at least 14 hours to build up enough that drive. Some people need more. Okay. But this is kind of a quick and dirty way of avoiding that trap of showing up too early for sleep. So this really hits home, I find, especially with the teens that I work with, because if they're, for example, sleeping in on Sunday until 2 p.m., which is not uncommon at all, that means that that night their body's not going to be ready for sleep until 4 a.m. And that's often a big aha moment, I find, for a lot of teens and the parents that I work with, because it's not an issue necessarily of them being able to settle to sleep. It's an issue of timing, right? There often is also the fact that they can't settle to sleep, but sometimes just addressing that can make a huge difference.
So what about people saying, I go to bed at 10 o'clock every night? Should we even be, you know, telling ourselves that number, or when 10 o'clock is approaching, that we should be saying, okay, I better slip into bed because, you know, this is my regular time. Is that wrong?
So yeah, that's really common advice. And I would say that's good advice in the context of also waking up at the same time every day. So it's good to have a regular schedule. It's good to think about winding yourself down at a certain time so that you can get enough sleep. But the bigger thing actually is a more consistent wake up time, because when you sleep in later, what happens is you get into that issue that I mentioned of not having enough time to build up enough sleep drive. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that when you sleep in later, that can cause delays in your body clock. So that can cause the body clock to shift later. And so what you don't want to do is, if you don't have potential for sleep at 10 p.m., you don't want to be getting into bed at that time, because it just then creates that opportunity for frustration, anxiety to set in. The other common thing that I see is that people are bored. They're lying there for hours. And so then they start picking up their phone, right? And very understandably. Yeah. And so then that, of course, can cause more issues with being able to settle too. So a lot of the advice out there for sleep is good advice, but you need to put it into context and you need to understand why that advice is being given. Mm-hmm. One of them addresses what you just talked about, which is the fact that we cannot get away from the fact that electronics are just built into our lives. Adults find it very difficult to put away their phones, but for teens, it's extra difficult. If you think about what matters to teens, right? And that's their peer, like their friends and connection. And also the fact that they're often not feeling sleepy anyways at that time, right? And that's when they have freedom at the end of the night. So it's really difficult, I would say, to tell a teen, just put away your phone an hour or two. And I never say that. Often people know, like often by the time people come to me, if they can do it, they're already doing it. If they can't do it, then me telling them to do it is not very helpful. And actually, it makes them feel even less heard and validated. So I like to tell people that there are still things that you can do in terms of reducing the impact of screens and the impact of light. The reason why screens are so bad for sleep is that that light, and in particular, the blue light that we obtain from screens, suppresses our production of melatonin. And melatonin is actually something that gets produced 3 to 5 hours before the onset of sleep. And so if you think about that, nobody can put away their phone at 7 or 8 p.m., right? But what you can do is you can reduce the impact of that light. So there are a lot of ways that you can do that. And it's actually quite easy. And I think probably the most obvious one that a lot of people know about is blue light filters on all of the screens. One thing a lot of people don't do is they put on those filters when they're going to bed, but actually you want those filters starting at, I'd say 7 p.m., 7 or 8 p.m. You can also do things like just generally turning off lights. We live in a world that's, we're just so used to being saturated by light. So LED lights in particular tend to have a lot of that harmful light. So turning those off, dimming the lights as much as possible, trying to go more towards just kind of that almost like candlelight conditions. Obviously, you don't want to light candles, but that's kind of what you're going for. Other things that can be helpful are, instead of using something that's closer to you, like a tablet or a phone, you can use TV is better, because TV, the further away the light source, the less impact it has on your sleep. So those are the types of things that can be helpful. I'd say the other one that I do often recommend is blue light blocking glasses. So the ones that have the amber tinted lenses can actually make quite a big difference. And that doesn't mean go free reins on your electronics, but it does reduce the impact. So those are the types of things that I think can be helpful.
In one of the episodes from one of your podcasts, a big point that I took away was the relationship that we have with our beds. Mm-hmm. You know, many times I even find myself, I'm not just reading a book in bed, I'm scrolling in my bed, I'm watching television in my bed. One of the things that you talk about is our relationship with our beds. So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
For sure. I had mentioned earlier that there were three big things. So this actually, you kind of brought me to the second thing that I often will tell people to address as those first three steps. So what often happens when we spend a lot of time awake in our bed, either because we're hanging out in bed doing other things, or because we can't sleep, and so we're lying in bed and we're tossing and turning, what can happen is essentially a very powerful relationship can develop between the bed and being in that state of not being able to settle and being awake, essentially. And this tends to happen a lot in the teen years, because as you probably know, teens love their beds, and it completely makes sense, right? They need to have somewhere where they can have privacy. And many teens, because of the fact that they're so set up for sleep issues, are often tired. And so they're defaulting back into their bed where they can rest and they can feel comfortable. But this is one thing that really, really drives issues with being able to settle and insomnia, because that unhelpful relationship with the bed, even if you're sleepy and you're ready for sleep, often people will say they get into bed and all of a sudden their mind wakes up and they become more alert. And it's because of that unhelpful relationship. The bed essentially has become a cue to go into awake mode. And what we want instead is we want bed to be associated with sleepy mode, right? We want to get into bed. And some people have that. They get into bed, they might be wide awake, they can do all sorts of stuff before bed. And then they get into bed and their head hits a pillow and they get sleepy. And so bed in that case has become a trigger or a cue for sleepiness. And so there has to be this retraining of the relationship that you have with your bed. And when people address that, it can make a huge, huge difference, which is why it's often one of the first places that I start. Now, the tricky thing is that even if we want to do certain things, it's very hard to do certain things in the moment. And so I will tell people about this retraining, but in terms of putting it into practice and doing it consistently enough to retrain that relationship with your bed, what I've found is that you need to have somewhere else to be so that you don't default into bed. So I talk about this, or I refer to this as a cozy nook to the teens that I work with. And so I typically suggest that it be a comfortable place in their room, so it's easy to get to, and that it be essentially like the equivalent of their bed. Like, it does all the things that their bed does for them, but it's not their bed. So they're not spending all that time awake in bed. And the idea, if you're wanting to then retrain that negative association with the bed, is that you're not getting into bed until you're really feeling as if you're on the edge of sleep. And so you're just cutting out all that time awake in bed. Typically, when I meet with people after they're sleeping better and I ask them why, this is the one thing they often reference, or they often say it has been most helpful.
And it just goes to show how far back the retraining needs to go for us, even as adults. When I think about my relationship with my bed is everything in my room. Any adult who's in midlife can probably look back decades and say, geez, I've been doing what I'm doing in bed now for the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good point. And I think in the past, I've worked with adults as well. I will often hear that story that my sleep problem started when I was a teenager. One thing to know about insomnia or chronic insomnia is that often there are the things that initially start the insomnia, right? There's something that's stressful, or it might have arisen in the context of a mood disorder, like a depressive episode. But insomnia can then really take on a life of its own. And what we just talked about in terms of that unhelpful association with the bed, that's one of the reasons, right? The other big one that I would say is that often when people aren't sleeping well, they start to view themselves as bad sleepers, or sleep becomes something that they can't do easily. They lose their confidence around sleep. And so there is a lot more focus on sleep, and there's more anxiety around sleep. And then that becomes essentially, it's almost like performance anxiety or a self-fulfilling prophecy, where then that drives even more sleep issues.
Mm-hmm. What about, you know, when you hear about business leaders saying that they can function very well on 3-4 hours of sleep a night? What do you mm-hmm. say to that?
Well, I mean, I think that's where, you know, Matt Walker, who wrote the book, Why We Sleep, I think he's doing a really good job educating people around the fact that we can think that we're doing fine on 3, 4, 5, 6 hours, but often we're not. And so it often does take having that experience of really, you know, often I'll talk about it like an experiment, carving out a couple weeks where you do target more sleep, and you can see the difference in terms of how you're functioning. I often talk about it like, you know, when you've had a cold, and then that one day you can breathe more easily. I'm like, oh, I forgot. I had no idea what this felt like. And I find that in my work with the teens that I see, they're just so used to being tired that sometimes they'll come in and they'll say, I'm fine, I'm functioning fine. But then once they're sleeping better, it's a completely different thing.
When someone comes in and tells you that they're functioning fine, what are you looking for?
Well, that's a great question, because my work with teens, so the difference between adults and teens is that often adults are much more, they know that sleep is a problem or something that they're wanting to address. Teens, for lots of different reasons, often they don't want to address their sleep. It's not the things that they need to do, or not what their friends are doing. It's not typically aligned with things that teens tend to value: freedom, having control, connecting with their peers, things like that. And then the other thing is that a lot of teens have actually tried to do things to improve their sleep, but partially because it's trickier in the teen years, or they haven't put things together in the right way or in the right order, they haven't had success with those strategies. And so then a very common thing that I hear is, I've tried everything and nothing works. So I find in my work, the bigger part of my job is actually selling it to teens. And I find that if a teen is really clear that their sleep is not problematic for them, often me going into convincing them is really, really unhelpful. So for a few different reasons, and I educate parents a lot about that too, about the approach that's going to work in terms of making it more likely that a teen wants to address her sleep. Sometimes it's that teens, they need to have certain information, and I find it's really helpful for them to stumble upon that information on their own so that they have ownership of it. But sometimes teens are just not in the place to want to change it, and pushing is never a good strategy in that situation, as you probably know. And so sometimes it's about waiting for your window, and them coming to the point where their sleep is costing them enough, and they're perceiving that they're going to want to make some changes. And then when that window opens up, then it becomes much easier and you're not getting into that power struggle.
So at what point do parents bring their teens to you?
Sometimes I see parents and teens, and the teen has raised the flag that it's a problem. And then the parent will kind of initiate going to see their primary care provider and then bring them in to see me. Sometimes it's that the teen sleep is really disrupting the family's life, right? You can't wake up the teen for school. They're asleep all day. It's resulting in so many downstream effects. And so in those situations, sometimes parents will bring in the teen, and the teen either is not seeing it as a problem, or they see it as a problem, but they're not yet ready to change. And so I can see all of those different scenarios, but typically in that scenario where the teen has been brought in or dragged in and they're not seeing it as a problem, it's often not a good idea to start engaging in any type of treatment, and sometimes even talking about sleep, because then it makes them dig in their heels and makes it less likely for them to want to address things.
I'm just thinking now about what you just touched on and how much of an impact something like sleep can take on an entire family.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the ways that you break through to that patient?
Well, so if a teen is completely not interested, I often will mention, okay, there are things that you can go take a look at. If you're interested, you're always welcome to come back and see me at a later time. But I don't go into things too much more, because what I always am aiming to do is to leave that door open to come, for them to want to come back to it at a later time. And I'm really trying to not have to play that role of the expert, or often, you know, the parent telling them what to do, right? Because I know that that's just really unhelpful. If I have a teen who's ambivalent, and you know, there's something there, they're interested, they know that there are some costs. What I have found has been most helpful is to really appeal to what matters to teens, right? So whether that's a goal, or linking it to something in their life that really matters and how the sleep is impacting that. When we really get into things, and this is part of, I have a program for teen insomnia, I bake a lot of the idea of understanding values into that program, because that's the thing that's going to be most motivating for all of us, right? If being able to sleep better means that I have more control over my life, that I'm going to have more freedom, that I'm going to be able to be a better friend and be more connected, then that can provide the motivation to want to do that work around sleep.
Yeah, sleep, God, it could be everybody's enemy and everybody's friend at the same time.
Yeah. And I think one thing I would love to jump in and just say, because I think I'm painting this picture of, it's so difficult to help teens sleep and there's so much working against them and there's this tricky dynamic. However, the reason why I do this work is that when you have a teen that's ready to do this work, and when they are kind of taught the right ways of making these changes, building these skills, building these habits, you can see change very quickly. And it's amazing. It's incredible. You can see change in a matter of sometimes days, often weeks, but it is something where it's a really helpful jumpstart. And that's what I was talking about earlier. And as you mentioned, I'm both a psychiatrist and a sleep physician. And the reason why I have really gone into just working in this field of sleep, and in particular in insomnia and sleep timing issues, is because I think there's tremendous potential. I think there's this really great intervention that we have that is often not being used, often being missed. So I don't want to leave people with no hope around sleep in the teen years. It is, and I've seen it all the time, even with really complicated situations, sleep can be a really helpful way in the door and a really helpful first intervention or first change.
And I mean, we can all sing the praises of when we have good night's sleep, how much better we feel as mm-hmm. a result of it.
Yeah, for sure.
Something that I hear more and more about is cognitive behavioral therapy.
Sure.
And now I'm hearing about it with insomnia. And mm-hmm. my own primary care physician has actually recommended that I explore it a little bit more, which I have been over okay. the last couple of months.
Okay.
Because yeah. I had been falling into the traps, and I want to talk about this as well, of some of the supplements that people mm-hmm. are known to take for sleep. But let's just talk a little bit about CBTI, if you can educate
Absolutely.
Us on that.
Sure. And so when I was talking earlier about my program that I've put together for teen insomnia, it incorporates elements of CBTI, but I've added some other stuff because of all of the challenges that you and I have been talking about so far. So CBTI is the first line treatment for chronic insomnia, and it's a fantastic treatment. So as I was just talking about, it's something where you can see change really quickly. So many people have heard of cognitive behavioral therapy for other things, like it's the first line treatment also for mood disorders, also for anxiety, a host of other things, and it works very well. But the difference with insomnia is that it works faster. So for mood and anxiety, typically a course of CBT may be somewhere between 12 to 20 sessions. It depends. But for insomnia, it's typically 4. And you can see that improvement normally within a couple weeks, I would say, is fairly typical. So it's a great treatment. And it incorporates 5 of the best treatments that we have for insomnia. So those 5 elements are sleep restriction therapy, stimulus control therapy, sleep hygiene, right, which all of us know about, relaxation training, and then also cognitive therapy. And I'm happy to break down what each of those are, but essentially those 5 things help with addressing what is fueling the insomnia. When we talked earlier about that idea of the fact that insomnia can take on a life of its own after you have the, you know, the acute things that have caused insomnia. And then the insomnia then takes on a life of its own because we start to focus more on sleep, we get more anxious about sleep, we develop this unhelpful association with our beds. The other thing I didn't mention is that we often then tend to do certain things to compensate for the fact that we're not sleeping well and we're tired. So a good example of this would be we start to rely more on naps, or we start to rely more on caffeine. And those are things that then drive the sleep problem even more. And so we get into these really vicious cycles. And essentially what CBTI does is it helps to address all of those things that are driving the more chronic insomnia. So it's not a panacea. It's not going to mean that you never have insomnia, but because once insomnia is established, the major things that are driving insomnia are those things that have caused it to take on a life of its own. So that's essentially what CBTI is. And normally we're starting with behavioral strategies. I had mentioned sleep restriction therapy and stimulus control and sleep hygiene. Essentially what you're doing with stimulus control and sleep restriction is you're following a very specific protocol to essentially kind of reset the system. And it's very behavioral and it works very quickly. And then after that, then you're layering on relaxation training to learn how to relax the body and power down the body, and cognitive training, which is addressing essentially the thoughts and the thought patterns that are driving insomnia.
Does keeping a journal on what you do day to day help?
Definitely, definitely. So part of CBTI, we use sleep logs. And I think a lot of people are often resistant to it, or is this really going to be helpful? But it can be
honestly,
really,
I think
really...
most people are scared to be seeing on paper what they
Fair
do.
Enough. Fair enough. And also just adding something more to the plate, right? And having to something every day, that too. So for that reason, actually, I have logs that I use that are different for the teens I work with, just because most of the time I was finding the teens weren't filling up the logs, but it's so helpful. So, you know, you can see patterns like on days when napping occurred or when caffeine was a bit later. You know, we often, because there are so many different things that can drive insomnia, it's really hard to actually know in the moment. I find that even for myself, if I'm having a bad night, sometimes I'll be unable to sleep, and then I don't know, an hour later, I'll be like, oh yeah, I have that caffeine or that coffee that I don't typically do that, but coffee at 4 p.m. or something like that, right? So it just helps you with understanding patterns and understanding what you might be able to modify.
Now, what about some of the extra help that many people are reaching for? Melatonin, valerian root, CBD?
In my practice, I don't recommend any of these things. However, I am never so black and white about it. So in terms of the studies, for any of those three things that you mentioned, we don't have the studies there to really say these are good sleep agents. For melatonin, which is something I'm often asked about, I will use it in very specific cases where there's a delayed body clock or delayed sleep phase, and I'll use it in a very different way. So I'll use it in much lower doses than what is typically being taken, like less than 1 milligram, typically 0.5, and it's timed much earlier. And it's being used as what we call a chronobiotic, so as a time setter for the clock, as opposed to a sedative or a sleep agent. Now, having said that, I don't use it all the time because there are other things that need to come together if you are using that as a way of helping to move the clock forward. But that would be the way in which I think that's rational use of melatonin. Normally, when sun starts to come down in the evening, that is when melatonin starts to rise in the body. And I think I mentioned this earlier, but then it starts to rise. And then 3 to 5 hours later, that's what helps facilitate sleep. Okay, so it kind of triggers sleep, but in a delayed way, you can say. When I have somebody who is sleeping on a much later schedule, let's say their body clock is such that they want to be sleeping between 2 a.m. and say 11 a.m., one of the ways that we can help with moving the clock earlier is by using low doses of melatonin timed, let's say 4 hours before sleep onset. So I'm always a little bit hesitant to share this on anything, you know, because I'm not giving medical advice and on, you know, things like this where I can't provide that context, but it's just one of the various things that can be used to help with moving the clock earlier. That's not going to work in isolation though. It has to be put together with other behavioral strategies. And also we use light to help move the timing of the clock as well. But that's a way in which I will use melatonin. I don't typically recommend it as a sleep agent, which is how a lot of people are using it. Because the studies actually have not really shown that it's that great of a sedative. And I think it's often important that people know that melatonin is a hormone, right? For whatever reason, it's available over the counter in Canada, where I am, and in the States, but it's a hormone. You know, we can't buy testosterone, but we can get it over the counter. And so it's not regulated. And so a few things to know about that is that they have done studies that show that the actual amount of melatonin can vary widely from what's on the label, anywhere, I think, from 85% to 400% of what's actually on the label. The other thing is that as it is a hormone, it can have impacts on other systems. So it has impacts on the immune system, and the reproductive system. So it's not benign the way in which I think a lot of people believe it to be. Now, sometimes people will find it very helpful. And whether that's placebo effect or whether that is a true effect, it's always a bit unclear. But if people have found it helpful, I don't normally tell them to come off of it right away, right? Because that's often then going to, you have to look at the bigger picture. But what I do often encourage people to do is to build these other strategies that are really powerful and then ideally taper off of the melatonin.
Okay. What's better for our kids? Being active with sports right before bedtime or having calm before bedtime?
So definitely calm before bedtime is a good idea. I think we now often have this idea that we can go from, you know, 100 to zero where we want to be for sleep. And that's just not possible, right? And everybody is a bit different, but we typically need some buffer between the stuff during the day that's going to make us alert and that we have to be on for, to be able to power down, to be able to then be able to settle to sleep and have a good night's sleep. Now, having said that, exercise is great for sleep, right? Exercise helps you with building that sleep drive. So for most people, doing exercise right before bed is not a good idea. But if that's the only time you can do exercise, and all in all, it's a net positive because it's helping you with building that drive for sleep, then for some people, it's okay.
Should you have a buffer though, between when you're hitting the pillow and when you finished your workout and had your shower, should there be some sort of a buffer zone in there?
Yeah, I would recommend that. I would recommend at least a couple hours, both because exercise is activating, but also when you want to sleep, you need your body temperature to come down. And so exercise is actually causing a rise in body temperature. And so that can make it difficult to settle as well.
You have two podcasts. Can you tell us a little bit about each of them?
Sure. So last year I put together a podcast series and it's called Find the Eight. It was intended for teens, but also for parents to listen to. And that came out of the fact that I was finding that I was repeating myself a lot in my clinic and often not having time to go into everything that I wanted to go into. The other thing that I was encountering was that many of the teens that I see are very tired when I see them. And so normally I have about 5 minutes to give them some information and then they just kind of tune out. And so that's why I created that series. It really covers a lot of the basics around sleep and some of my initial recommendations, strategies for sleep. And they're all short. So they're all 10 minutes or less. So that's Find the Eight. And then more recently this year, I launched another podcast called the Decode Project Podcast. And this is a podcast that's intended for parents and for anybody working with teens. And it's a longer form of podcast. So I have interviews. I have some episodes as well where I'm sharing information too. But the idea behind this podcast is that one of the reasons why I love the work that I do in sleep and why I do it is that sleep is, I've found to be a really great first change for teens. And a lot of the things that you can learn from getting your sleep on track, a lot of the frameworks and even the strategies can translate to other changes. And so the podcast is actually a more general podcast about how do we best support teens and how can we draw from different areas and take those same frameworks and those same strategies and apply them to sleep as well as to the next change after the sleep is on track. So yeah, I interview various experts, a lot of my colleagues in psychiatry or other therapists. And then I also interview parents to get their perspective as well as younger people as well.
Before we wrap up, let's go through the top tips again that you have for parents. Mm-hmm.
The top tips for parents. Okay. So I mentioned those three things. So the first one, make sure that you're not forcing your teen to bed too early. Okay. And having some understanding of the timing of their body clock and when they're going to have enough drive can help you with knowing, what time would be a better bedtime for them. The second would be this idea of having another place to be so that the bed doesn't become a default and there isn't all that time awake in bed. I actually have a handout called the 5 tips for parents to help your teen sleep better, even if your teen isn't interested. So I find that there is a stuff, like even though I talked about you don't want to push it or push an agenda until they're ready, there is stuff that you can do behind the scenes that sometimes just setting up a place for your teen. Often teens like that. Like they like the idea of setting up like a fun place in their room. That can be helpful as well, because even though they may not follow that idea of not getting into bed until sleepy, they're just less likely, right? That you're shaping the environment such that they're less likely to be spending time awake in bed. Third one's around light. So there are various strategies to make sure that you are reducing light as much as you can in the 3 to 5 hours before bedtime. One thing I didn't talk about that is also making sure that that there's more light in the morning. So for parents, I often tell them that even opening the blinds, even if their eyes are still closed, if they're going to tolerate that and it's not going to cause a fight, that actually helps in terms of setting the body clock.
Their kid isn't going to throw something at them.
Exactly. And then the other two things that I mentioned are actually focusing on connection. And so I know that this is not a sleep tip, but when that connection's there with the teens and the parents that I work with, it's so much easier to actually get in the door and for teens to want to make these changes. And then when parents can be involved, it's so much easier for the teens to make the changes, because often teens, when I see them at the beginning, they're exhausted and they're ambivalent, right? They're not so sure that the stuff is going to work for them. And so having the parent at the beginning really to help with reminding them if they want reminders, helping them with setting things up, it makes a huge difference. The last one is, again, kind of one of those things you can do behind the scenes. But so far, we've talked about the idea of napping not being helpful for sleep, and also sleeping in too late not being helpful for sleep. Something that parents can do, again, with not directly addressing sleep, is scheduling fun stuff at that time with their teen, if that's something that you think your teen will go for. So scheduling fun activities so they're not sleeping until two on the weekends helps with them not getting into this vicious cycle where the clock is just running later and later. Same thing, scheduling stuff at those high-risk times for naps for teens, like after school is often when teens take naps. So if it's something that is fun for them, that is often has like a social context to it, like with their friends as well, that also can help, right? Because then they're not napping, and then that's not resulting in delaying when their body's going to be ready for sleep.
Where can we access the handout?
So I think the easiest place to find all of the stuff that I've created is my website, so decodeinsomnia.com.
Everything that you've talked about with me is stuff that can be related to adults and teens and, you know, younger children as well. One of the things that I'm taking away from our conversation is also the importance of us role modeling to our kids, you know, not just preaching to them on all the things that they need to be doing, but to be incorporating a lot of the advice that you've been sharing in our own lives.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, I've been thinking about redoing that tip sheet and adding that as one, because role modeling it is helpful, right? It is extremely helpful. And not only is it helpful to model it, but if you're asking your teen to do something and you're not doing it yourself, they're not going to do it.
Yeah.
Right. So that's another piece.
Here's my last question for you. How's your sleep?
Good question. So I am somebody who definitely has a tendency towards insomnia. My mother has insomnia. I think just my predisposition is to have it. And so, as I mentioned, sometimes we just have a bad night's sleep, right? And even when we know these things, even when we do all of the stuff that we need to be doing, sometimes there's just stress in life, or there are things that just result in having a bad night's sleep. And so I definitely have that. And I often try to be grateful in those moments that it really helps me understand how painful it is to have insomnia, and has really helped me in terms of coming up, I think, with better resources and solutions, and helps me have some empathy, I think, in working with both the parents and the teens that I work with.
It's been a great conversation with you. Thank you so much for sharing your insights.
Oh, my pleasure.
You may be thinking about your kids and their sleep habits while listening to Dr. Uwe. Or perhaps you're also considering the changes that you'll make to maybe your bedroom, the light around you, and sleep timing in order to get a better night's sleep. I hope that her guidance will help your family to get the sleep that you need. I hope you enjoyed this conversation I had with Dr. Kara Uwe. I'd like to thank her so much for joining me. To learn more about Dr. Uwe, visit decodeinsomnia.com. I want to thank you for listening to this episode. Resilient People is created by me, Janet Fanacki. Theme music is Sundays by R. Lamar. To get in touch with me, please visit resilientpeople.ca and send me a note on the contact page. You can also access my Instagram and Twitter page links there and start following me on socials. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review Resilient People on Apple Podcasts and to share it with your community. And the new Resilient t-shirts have come in, and I'd love for you to order one. All proceeds benefit the Adam Fanacki Brain Fund, which provides financial support to charities across Canada that help brain tumor patients and their caregivers. To date, we've raised over $250,000. They are cool and make a statement, so please order a Resilient t-shirt on the website, which again is resilientpeople.ca. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Till next time, I'm Janet Fanacki. Bye for now.